Welcome into Birdwatch, a New Orleans Pelicans podcast powered by NOLA.com. I'm your host, Christian Clark. I'm the New Orleans Pelicans beat writer for NOLA.com. Here today with producer Jeff Nowak.
Hey, y'all.
And special guest, Raina Kemp, the deputy sports editor of the New Orleans Advocate.
What's up, people?
We are now on the Apple Podcast app. Go subscribe there. This is episode number 2, and today we're going to be talking about Pelicans defense. We're going to get into Raina's career at Louisiana Tech, and we're also going to talk about the big game this week. You might have heard of it. The Los Angeles Lakers are coming into town Wednesday. Raina, I've known you for a couple of years now. We worked together at the Oklahoman in Oklahoma City. I got to know you while I was working those sports desk shifts at night, laying out pages. We kind of became friends then, and I'm really happy how it worked out. We get to work together all these years later. You are a Louisiana Tech basketball alum, a Lady Texter. Can you please explain to me what a Lady Texter is?
Yeah, I needed that explanation myself when I went down for a visit. I'm like, okay, I want to play basketball for you guys, but first of all, what is that? The way it was explained to me is back in the golden ages, back when lady basketball players were, you know, you're supposed to wear sleeves. You're not even going to show your shoulders. We're really hitting on being ladies and not trying to be masculine like the men. The president at the time would go to the games and didn't like how the opponents were taunting his players because Louisiana Tech's actual mascot is the Bulldogs. And being called the Lady Bulldogs, you can just imagine the type of chants and things that came along with that type of title from the opponents. And the president didn't really like that much, so he decided to rename all of the women's sports programs from Lady Bulldogs to the Lady Texters to play off Louisiana Tech. And it just kind of stuck from there, and here we are with a title that really makes no sense, but kind of became its own.
Yeah, I could see how Lady Bulldogs could be a little bit problematic. What was your style on the court? Give me like the back of the card scouting report.
For me, I was signed to play shooting guard at Louisiana Tech, which was perfect for me at my height. I'm 5'10", and I spent the whole summer before working on my shot, working on my ball handling, only to get there and maybe a week or two in was told that I now must play power forward. So that was a heck of a shift for me, especially not only playing power forward, even though I had a little bit of the fundamentals down because I played 1-5 in high school, but college is a completely different level. And the average power forward in college is about 6'3", 6'4", 6'5". And that was definitely a major shift for me. So I went from thinking I knew what I was going to be doing to almost having to completely relearn the game.
So how big were the power forwards in your conference? Were you like really undersized?
I'm very undersized. I was the average size of a shooting guard, yeah, which was what I was supposed to be. I was supposed to be a shooting guard. So 5'10", you know, 5'9" was pretty average there. The average small guard was between 6 foot and maybe 6'2", and the average power forward was between about 6'3", 6'5". So very, very undersized, and not only 5'10", but I was pretty thin there too. So I spent a lot of time hitting the wood floor, a lot of bruises and bumps from that. But I got to think that I learned a lot about shifting my body weight and knowing that it's not necessarily all about weight, but how to balance your weight when playing defense or playing offense against an opponent that's much bigger than you.
So last Texter-related question I got for you before we kind of get into Pelicans talk, but you played for Teresa Witherspoon at Louisiana Tech. What was that experience like? A living legend.
Yeah, I think that's one of the main reasons why I decided to go there. At the time of recruiting in high school, I was getting looked at from a lot of different schools, from your JUCO level all the way up to D1. And when Teresa Witherspoon calls, and you know, you look up all of the accolades if you don't know them, they're unmatched. And of course, you want to, if your goal is to play basketball at the highest level, you want to play for someone with those type of accolades. I'll never forget the first time that we all got together in the locker room to talk before actually going to practice. You know, she came in with just so much intensity just to get started with practice. And it was a little bit intimidating just to see the high expectations she had for us, even us freshmen from Jump Street. But with that being said, that's the kind of coach she was. There was no, you know, oh, well, she's just a freshman, or she's undersized, or we put her at a new position 2 weeks in. That's not an excuse. She expects the best from you. She expects you to go hard at everything, even if you don't necessarily understand what she's telling you to do. Give it everything you have. And there is no excuse not to do that. Playing for her prepares you for life, because no matter what you're going through in your personal life or whatever it is, she always expects the best from you and expects you to give maximum effort. That's how things goes in life as well. You know, you always have to give your best. Even when you fail sometimes, you still got to get back up and keep going at it. Full speed ahead. And that can really mess with you mentally to fail or to not succeed at your goal time and time again, but to keep getting up and trying again, keep getting up and trying again with no excuses. So I think Teresa Weatherspoon was very instrumental in me being where I am today, just as far as being somebody that's resilient and just keep getting back up and keep trying again. And when I found out that she would be one of the coaches for the Pelicans, I knew right off the bat that would be a perfect fit for them, because the Pelicans in their history has had to get back up, keep trying again, and have to somehow keep having this mindset that at some point in time they will be a perennial franchise. She is someone that will teach them and keep pushing them to strive for that goal no matter how many times you get knocked back down. So I think that's going to be a great fit, and it so far I believe it is. So we'll see where they go as the year goes on.
So do you have a defining Coach Weatherspoon is fed up story, when she like broke a clipboard in half or punched a locker or something that you're willing to share here? But is there a defining Coach Weatherspoon was not having it story?
I'm not even sure if there's one. I mean, because our trainers and our assistants, those graduate students that come and travel with the team and help, you know, carry bags and do all those things, they knew that they had to keep carrying dry erase markers and keep carrying the clipboards, because she would often break them game after game after game.
Wow. So you just had like dry erase boards on deck.
Right. You had to have them on deck. You had to have the pens, not the pens. You have to have the dry erase markers and the clipboards on deck, because 9 times out of 10, they would not make it back from the road. I don't think there was just any one time that she did anything like to make you feel like, whoa, no, nothing like that. She's a very intense person. I can say one of my experiences from my freshman year, you know, I've made it through conditioning and everything. We just started the season. And when I say made it through conditioning, I mean that very literally. I made it through conditioning. So I'm like, okay, well, that should be the toughest part of the season. And we started playing. We had a couple good games. We lost to LSU by 3 points my freshman year. That we hosted them in Ruston. It's a very good game. And that was actually our first loss, I believe. And she wasn't too hard on us for that because, you know, LSU's a perennial state school, and we played them pretty matched. But a couple games after that, we played Mississippi State at home, another SEC team. And I feel like we were leading at halftime. And they ended up rallying and beating us. And in my mind, you know, I'm a freshman. In my mind, I'm like, okay, if another SEC team came in and beat us, maybe she won't be as mad as she was, you know, because at the same way she was with LSU. Not really. She came in the locker room. I remember her telling us, this is about 9:30 at night right now. You have practice tomorrow at 6 a.m., and you better make it through practice. She had never said, you better make it through practice before. And I barely am making it through practice now. So if she felt the need to make that disclaimer, then practice is about to be on a whole nother level of difficult. I remember calling my mom after that, almost in tears, and I'm like, Mom, I don't think I'm gonna make it through tomorrow. Like, I really just don't think if what I experienced so far was a regular practice and tomorrow is supposed to be the next level, I don't think I'm gonna make it through that.
What'd your mom say?
I'm on scholarship. Like, you better get to practice. As long as she's, you know, they're paying for your education, you do what they tell you to do. But, you know, I come to find out that practice is a lot more mental than it is physical. You can be in some of the best shape of your life, but if you're not mentally prepared for what practice is, which is a whole lot of roadblocks, not only for you, but your team. You know, if your teammate messed up, the entire team has to run or has to, you know, make up for that. It's way more mental than it is physical. That day, that next day, because I was mentally prepared for this being probably the worst thing that I would have to go through in my life, because she said, hey, you better make it through practice. It really ended up not being that bad because I expected the worst. And that came to be a trend. The worst practices that I ended up having was because for whatever reason I wasn't expecting practice to be that bad, or my mind was elsewhere with tests or whatever else was going on in my life, and I did not have time to mentally prepare myself for what was about to happen and what could possibly happen in practice. So that was one of the main things that, to me, I always tell, you know, younger athletes when it comes to them getting ready for the next level, that being able to compete on that level, whether it's in practice, in the games, or whatever, is just as much, if not more, mental than it is physical.
So fair to say Coach Weatherspoon put you through the ringer a little bit.
She definitely put us through the ringer. But with that being said, it made us champions.
So just kind of looping back around to the Pelicans part of all of this. Obviously, someone with a close connection to women's college basketball, Teresa Weatherspoon, the Pelicans, you know, Gail Benson's the owner, Swing Cash, UConn legend, you know, starred for, you know, a decade in the WNBA. You know, how, as someone who has that tight connection to women's college basketball and basketball in general, how impactful is that to the NBA as you watch a team like the Pelicans kind of spearhead that movement into, you know, gender diversity in the coaching staff, the front office?
I think it's very important, and I'm so glad that the Pelicans are jumping on that and being one of the first teams to get into that. The Spurs were really one of the first to, you know, hire Becky Hammond, and now she's first chair, like she's on the first row, and we see that it can work, you know. And her, I feel like it was her first summer there. She was the head coach for the summer league team, and they won the championship. And I think that was a lot of people's perceptions about hiring women in a male-dominated sport, that they wouldn't get the respect and they wouldn't get men to listen to them and buy into what they're saying as much as a man would. And I think she definitely was a pioneer, and a lot of other teams seeing that, it's like, oh, it could work. And I'm glad that the Pelicans took that into consideration when hiring Swin and then hiring Coach Spoon, because outside of gender or color or any of those things, if you're qualified and you are someone who can help them get better, you should be on the roster. And a lot of times, people like Becky Hammond, like Teresa Weatherspoon, like Swin Cash, you look at their resume and it is outstanding. The accolades come in from the high school level to the college level to the professional levels, and then zip back around to coaching. There is absolutely no reason why they should not be a part of these franchises and why they could not help them succeed. I don't know Swin Cash personally, but I'm a huge fan of her as a player growing up. Teresa Weatherspoon, I do know her personally. And like I said before, right off the bat from hearing that she was hired, I knew right off the bat that that would be a great hire, because I know what she can bring to any program across the country, if not around the world. She is very, very knowledgeable in the game. She is very, very passionate. She is a people person. She is the kind of person that you want to have around if you want to succeed. And I think that over the years, maybe in the next 5 to 10 years, we might see our first head coach in Division I men's basketball first. We have to baby step it. I don't want to act like, you know, you know, like this is just going to change the entire, you know, when it comes to change like that, when you have to baby step those things. And I was actually surprised that Becky Hammond didn't get that college coaching job. I can't remember where it was. It was like a Division II, Division III school that she was up for. And they ended up giving it to somebody else. But I'm surprised she didn't get the job, because, I mean, she's an assistant coach for the Spurs. You would think somebody with that on their resume would be a shoo-in. But, you know, she had a couple interviews and ended up giving it to somebody else who, not saying they weren't qualified, but didn't have those type of accolades on their record. But I do think that that's to come first. And then who knows in the future where it could go. And I'm really excited to see, not only in basketball, but in football as well, they're getting more coaches and more trainers and personal development and professional development type coaches in there. And I'm just excited to see women get their foot in the door in men's women's professional sports.
Yeah, even on the side of officials, you know, you see a lot more women, and, you know, even NFL refs, NBA refs, so that's...
I honestly think to a certain degree that might be tougher. Like, from the standpoint of being a woman and getting into that profession, because I think the officials catch more slack or whatever than coaches do. You know, we've seen officials. Think about here in New Orleans and how New Orleans has reacted to officiating after the Saints game against the Rams last year, and how I don't think they will ever let that go. You know, a coaching snafu, we'll talk about it, but eventually you'll let it go. I mean, eventually we stop talking about the Seahawks' decision to throw the ball on the 1 yard line in the Super Bowl. Eventually.
Should we
stop talking about it? I don't know. I think that's something that needs to be revisited at some point. But eventually we got over it. I don't think that we will ever stop talking about the officiating with the pass interference, because officials are way more scrutinized, I believe, than coaches. Then you add a woman being an official in a male-dominated sport, and it's just tenfold. Because even as a journalist, I haven't been a part of this too much because I'm a little bit more behind the scenes when it comes to journalism and the sports world. But I've worked with several journalists. Jenny Carlson and at the Oklahoma is one of those that can attest to this, that the amount of comments that they get on social media, you know, from people who don't think they know what they're talking about solely because they're women. It has nothing to do with how long, you know, she's been a part of it or been writing or been officiating, whatever you want to say. You obviously don't know what you're talking about. You're a woman. So you take that same mindset that a lot of people seem to have about women in sports, and you make them, they kind of control the flow of the game as a ref. And any call that they make from a travel to a block to whatever is, it's going to be like, oh my God, that call was horrible. You know, yeah, you know, I've seen all kind of things like that on social media, where if James Harden gets away with a travel and a male ref doesn't see it, oh yeah, the refs are trash. But if there's a woman referee, that is a whole different level of misogyny that comes with it. And I just know that it's a whole nother level, and I commend them for wanting to still step into that spotlight and still pave the way, despite all of the backlash and the misogyny that comes with it.
Yeah, people assume you have credibility in sports because you're a guy. There's just no question about it. I think the good thing in the NBA is it's becoming, like, not normal, but it's becoming a little more typical for, you know, women to hold those assistant coaches positions, for them to hold positions in the front office. And it's not so much a thing of like, oh, look, a woman has, you know, she's taken over this post now. It's like, oh yeah, this is just a thing that happens now. So
yeah,
I do see it trending in the right way. And I think we will get a woman's head coach in the NBA in the next decade. It wouldn't surprise me at all. So it's good to see that progress. And I think that, you know, the Pelicans front office, one of the best things about Griff is that he's open to bringing in people from different backgrounds, different perspectives, because, you know, if you have everyone from the same perspective, you're just going to have blind spots. And I think, you know, Pelicans front office, they cover up each other's blind spots. And, you know, I think that's a really good thing.
That's the great thing about diversity in general and any aspect or whatever, is be able to cover each other's blind spots. The one thing that you might not see or think about as a man, maybe I would think about it as a woman. Or maybe you might not see because you're white. I might see because I'm black. And some people might think that's no, you know, that's not something you should visit. But it is. It is something that can only help you in any situation, is to be able to have a lot of different perspectives that can come together and really tackle things from all angles.
Back here on Birdwatch, New Orleans Pelicans podcast powered by NOLA.com. Here with Rainey Kemp, the New Orleans Advocate, Deputy Sports Editor, and Jeff Nowak, sports producer for NOLA.com. Wanted to spend a little time talking about the Pelicans' defense. You know, I think through these first 17 games, that's clearly been the biggest thing that's holding them back. And the last, or the 48 hours over the weekend where they played Utah and the Clippers, I think was a pretty good indication of just how far there is to go against some of the Western Conference's class teams. I'm just looking at the Pelicans' defensive profile overall. is pretty ugly. They're third to last in defensive efficiency overall, 27th in defensive rebounding rate, 25th in opponents' points off turnovers, 30th in opponents' fast break points. They give up a ton of shots at the rim and from corner three. I mean, they're not very good in the half court or transition. And, you know, after the game, I was not with the team on the road, but Alvin Gentry was asked about the defense, and he did criticize the defense, but there was also kind of an aside in there. He's like, well, you can't give up 40 points unless you score 45 points. I don't know. I kind of think there is a mindset here of we just got to outscore them sometimes, and I don't think that's necessarily one that I agree with. I think that, you know, when you look at these 17 games, there are real issues that need to be corrected defensively.
No, I think Alvin Gentry somewhat adopted that philosophy that, you know, if you score 45, you have to limit them to 40 or whatever the case is. I think he kind of adopted that from the Golden State Warriors in his time there because for a good bit of their time, the Golden State Warriors weren't necessarily a perennial defensive team, but they were a very perennial offensive team. They could put up 150 points or whatever easily. You have two players that can score 40 points, 50 points on any given night in three quarters with Klay Thompson and Stephen Curry. And it got to the point where they didn't absolutely need to play great defense because they played so lights out on offense. But you don't have that situation here. You don't have a Stephen Curry or a Klay Thompson who can score 40 and 50 points in three quarters. You have a good bunch of role players and maybe one or two players with star potential, like Brandon Ingram, possibly Zion when he comes back. And that philosophy just won't work here. In my experience of just watching the game and being a part of the game, the biggest part about playing defense is communication. You cannot play great defense without communication. You being a good one-on-one defender can only get you so far on a team that is great offensively and knows how to move the ball, who knows how to pick and roll, who knows how to cut. That communication, I believe, can come over time. You have to understand, too, that this is fairly a brand new team. And I would like to think that is something that they are working on, is being able to understand each other's strengths and weaknesses and be able to adjust. Brandon Ingram was talking about that the other day, about, yeah, he's kind of coming into his own scoring, but he has to play better on defense. He has to be able to help his teammates out when they get beat, be able to provide his length in the lane and step up. And it's not just him at all. Pretty much the entire team needs to have that same mindset and needs to kind of double down on the defensive side because they're not bad offensively by any means. At some point in time, they had the number one, if not number two, offense in the league. But it's about doubling down on defense, and I think that's where JJ can come in as a veteran and as someone who's played on multiple playoff teams and made deep playoff runs. I feel like he can be a great asset in talking to a lot of the young players and getting them on the same page defensively.
Yeah, the Pelicans gave up 70 points in the first half in Utah and L.A., and it's just really hard to win that way. I mean, already four times this year they've given up 130-plus points. It's tied with the Wizards for the most in the league. You know, I think the communication thing, which you said, is interesting. I think they have a lot of quiet guys on this team. Jrue Holiday's a quiet guy. Brandon Ingram, I mean, Alvin Gentry goes in front of the media and kind of makes fun of how quiet he is. And, you know, that's not to say they can't figure it out, but I agree that communicating a little bit more would help. I think all the injuries have obviously played a huge role. It's just when you don't have any continuity, when you've rolled out 11, 12 different starting lineups in 16, 17 games, it's really difficult. You know, I kind of made this point on the last podcast, but I think Derek Favors missing so much time has been really critical for this team. He's been out the last five games with what the team says is back spasms. He's only played in nine games this year. I think Derek Favors is a sneaky important piece for this team. Here's kind of a take for you guys. But I think Derek Favors is just as important to this team as Brandon Ingram. I think Jrue Holiday is the most important guy, but I think Favors offers you just like a baseline of competence on the defensive end and on the glass, which, you know, both areas of Pelicans are awful right now, that Jahlil Okafor and Jackson Hayes, as flashy as he is sometimes, just can't provide.
Yeah, I mean, you can dive into advanced analytics all you want to look at the defense and look at where they're deficient and where they're succeeding. But you don't even have to go that deep. I mean, you can look at just the splits from wins and losses, and they're so disparate. In games that the Pelicans have allowed opponents to score 110 points or fewer, the Pelicans are 4-2. They've only won 6 games. I'm sorry, they're 4-1, and they're 2-11 in games that have allowed 110 points or more. It's so clear that you need to at least be competitive on the defensive side of the ball with this team. It doesn't have a lot of elite scoring talent beyond Brandon Ingram and Drew Holiday. You look at a guy like Jackson Hayes, who's really, you know, he's a pure effort, flying all over the floor type guy, but he is limited on the offensive end. But if you can find a way to just be in the game, you have a chance, because this team can score. You know, they're averaging, what, 110, 115 a game? I mean, if your average points scored is more than your average points allowed, you're gonna be a decent team, right? That's the most basic way you can look at it. You know, and will that change when Zion Williamson comes back? Will that change when Derek Favors is healthy, if he can, you know, find a way to stay healthy? Probably. But it's something that you look at and you have to just turn on the alarms, because there doesn't seem to be any continuity on the defensive side of the ball. And as all the good feelings about that 3-game winning streak they just had, the Pelicans are probably the best team in the NBA at beating teams that don't have their star players. They beat Portland without Damian Lillard. They beat Golden State without basically their entire lineup. They beat the Clippers without Kawhi Leonard. Paul George did come back for that one.
Yeah, they kind of have beat up on these teams that have been like heavily depleted. Yeah.
And to be fair, they're in the same boat. Those are the games, as an NBA team, to be competitive, you have to win those games. But they have not. The only team that they beat at full strength was the Nuggets.
I don't say this with any disrespect at all. It's just a fact. Jackson Hayes is still a kid. Like, he's 19 mm-hmm. years old, and it's easy to get intoxicated with some of the highs when he swats a shot into, like, the 19th row. But he's still learning how to play basketball, and the Pelicans have been consistent in messaging that. You know, I think he had 5 fouls in 21 minutes versus Phoenix. He's still very much learning the game. So, I think it's natural for him to have that learning curve. But when you don't have Favors in there, I think it's just really, really tough for you.
It also seems that the first halves of these games have been especially poor in terms of limiting teams. The second half of the Blazers game, they clamped down, and, you know, I think they allowed in the 60s in the first half, and I think they limited him to 104 at the end of the game. Why is that? Is there something that you see at the beginning of the game that just they can't get into the flow of it defensively? Because it seems like in the second half they seem to find a way to clamp down, but they're already down 20 points. They've allowed 72 points at halftime. They just can't make up that gap.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can pinpoint one thing, but like the Utah and the Clippers game remind me of like when a football team gets down 28-0 and they rack up a lot of stuff in garbage time and it looks closer than it really was. I guess maybe not the Clippers game, but like the Pelicans got it to like 4 and 6 points in the second half, but they weren't really in those games. I mean, it was kind of a butt whooping from the very beginning. So you would like to see just more urgency to start the game.
I wonder if it's somewhat of a scouting thing as well. It could very well be coming into the game in the first half and getting, like you say, punched in the mouth, and then going into the locker room at halftime and adjusting and saying, hey, you know, they're doing this really well, so we're going to adjust and do this real well, and coming into the second half and making those changes, and now you're on a run, but too little too late. There could be a lot of different factors, is my point, as into how they get off to a slow start. They could be one of those second-half teams right off the bat that, you know, you can easily just say, hey, they're a second-half team. Or you could say it's scouting. Right. Or you can say, you know, so there's so many different things that it could be. But the fact of the matter is you cannot win that way.
Well, I will say that being a second-half team is not an inherently negative trait, right? Like, a lot of the best teams in the NBA are really good second-half teams. And that's a good quality to have. You want a team that kind of, regardless of what happened in the first half, they come out in the second half firing, and they have closed these gaps. I mean, they were down 20-plus against Utah, and they made it a respectable game. They did the same thing against the Clippers, and they ended up losing those games. But the quality of being able to disassociate from a bad half and make a run is a very positive sign. But they need to find a way to put themselves in a situation where they're not constantly trying to do that. Where they're not constantly trying to punch up and roll, you know, they're rolling a rock up a hill, a boulder up a hill, and then they just can't get to the top and it falls down.
And that takes a lot out of you, you know, 82 games in a year in a season, and you're having to climb back from down 20 every single night. That is a lot to have to come back from, whereas trying to play within 5 points, 10 points a night. They have to try to climb back from that night in, night out, sometimes back-to-back games. You're making it tougher on yourself, and especially your veteran players, and it's definitely not going to help those players that are injury-prone to have to deal with those type of situations night in and night out.
And that's another thing. You look at the wins and losses, you know, in those six games they won, there was a very clear trend of, okay, this is either a close game throughout or, you know, they're holding the lead throughout. And in the games they've lost, that hasn't been the case. Like, the only game that really jumps out at me that they started well and fell off was the Mavericks game, which is very early in the season, and they're clearly still trying to figure out rotations. And I think the way the first quarter of games and, you know, the first half in general is something to really look at and something that should be targeted for improvement. You know, and if there's a way that to pinpoint what's going on, whether the rotations at the beginning of the game aren't what they need to be, or, you know, there's an issue in the way that the game is approached and the way that people are preparing to play that isn't getting people in that mindset that they need to be in to play. You know, not elite defense. You're not asking for elite defense. You're just asking for what's the alternative to 72 points in the first half, right? And all this comes with a grain of salt because this is a team that doesn't have Zion Williamson. And when he comes back, that's going to be a paradigm shift on all levels for this team, defensively, in transition. You know, how they approach the offensive end in the pick and roll and with spacing. So, you know, in a month, this could be something that you look back and it's like, yeah, remember when they couldn't play defense. But they also, in order for this not to be a lost season, for Zion's rookie year to not get the Joel Embiid treatment of, you know, no back-to-backs and mandatory rest days, they need to keep this respectable. And they have a rough stretch coming up, and it could easily go the wrong way.
Well, the bad news is that one of the most terrifying pick-and-roll duos is coming into town Wednesday night. Right.
This is, I think most people know that guy pretty well.
Do you know who he is? Anthony something?
He had a unibrow?
Yeah.
He did.
I think that might have been his defining...
He tricked people into shaving it off, but I think that was some movie magic.
So, yes, as we know, Lakers are coming into town Wednesday for the first time since the Anthony Davis trade. I got a kick out of AD's interview with Shams Charani of The Athletic. I think that AD has a pretty good idea of what's waiting for him. He knows that it's not going to be terribly pleasant. If there is any question, we got a pretty good hint during the Trailblazers game when AD was showed on the Jumbotron and the Boo Birds came out a little bit. You know, I'm not in the business of, like, telling fans what to think. You know, you're paying the money. You should do what you want to do. And, you know, if I was a paying fan, I would certainly understand being kind of frustrated with what happened last year.
Yeah, I mean, to put that booing moment into perspective for you, this was a game where the Smoothie King Center fans cheered for Carmelo Anthony's first basket. The opposing team had a player who scored, and the fans very loudly cheered for, you know, home fan base cheering for guys who never played there. And then when they played the preview schedule with Anthony Davis on it, it was a long boo. You know, and this was not a loud crowd for that game, and it went on for a while. So I think that kind of gives you a little perspective of how people are feeling. And I think saltiness is very reasonable for how that all played out. But at a certain point, it's non-productive, right? At a certain point, if you're the players on the team, it's kind of like, you know, you broke up with someone and you just can't stop bringing them up every time you go on a date with your new significant other, right?
Well, they broke up with you, but yeah.
That's true.
I'm not talking about from a player's perspective. I'm talking about from a fan's perspective.
I understand, but like at a certain, it's also like, this is a new team. This is a completely new team. And, you know, these players are human beings. They notice that stuff. You know, that they know that there seems to be more emotional energy spent yelling at Anthony Davis than actually, you know, watching the games. And that's, I think that, you know, that kind of goes into just the culture around the team. And it's easy to get frustrated when it feels like everything's going against you. When Zion Williamson is the savior of the franchise, or, you know, don't tell David Griffin I said that because they'll get mad because Drew Holiday is the owner of the team. Or it's Drew Holiday's team. I shouldn't say he's the owner. But that's how fans viewed it. You know, they were like, wow, we've just been hammered on for so long. Anthony Davis leaves and we finally get something nice, you know, a nice, shiny, new present to unwrap. And then it's failure to launch, and now you're stuck here as a fan watching Anthony Davis roll into town with all his new buddies, and the Pelicans are kind of in neutral.
Well, the Pelicans' entire marketing slogan this year is "Won't bow down." During some of the commercials you see on TV during games, they allude to, you know, a king. New Orleans hasn't had a king in 200 or 300 years. You know, I think that that's kind of said with what happened last year, at least in mind. I don't think, you know, Pelicans ever say that publicly or anything, but I definitely think what went on last year, you know, played a part in just their entire marketing campaign this year. I don't know about you guys, but I think the most ridiculous part of the whole saga, if I'm looking for just one moment, was when Anthony Davis wore the "That's All Folks" t-shirt to his last game as a Pelican. And, you know, when he was asked about it, he said he just wore what his stylist laid out for him. Rainey, do you pick your own clothes, or does your stylist pick them for you?
I definitely pick out my own clothes, but from what I've seen online, even if you do have a stylist, you still have some say-so. You know, you're not a toddler. You're not just having your clothes laid out on the bed and then, you know, they're putting their shirt on over your head for you and making sure your shoes are tied. You're a grown man, and you decide what you want to wear, and there is no way he was not aware what that shirt would represent and what it would mean in the last game as a Pelican. So to say that, oh, well, you know, this was just a coincidence that I wore this shirt at this specific time with everything that was going on, it's very much not true. And there's no reason to believe it is true. You said that that was one of the defining moments on what kind of made the fans a little salty. That is one of the moments. One of the other moments that stood out to me is when he and his agent, Rich Paul, left the game at halftime. Yeah, he was hurt. Was it a shoulder?
It was before the All-Star break. So
yeah, he hurt himself. And
some might call that unprofessional.
I personally would agree with that. I mean, to get dressed and to leave and get dressed without a stylist, I may add, and leave the stadium at halftime, that goes to show you right then and there he has no interest at all of finishing the season out and letting this play out respectably. So you cannot then expect the fans to turn around that same respect with the way that things played out. I think that a lot of fans were not shocked that he wanted to leave. This is a fan base that had dealt with receiving star players and them leaving at some point in time, because the Pelicans and before then the Hornets were kind of like, you know, the black sheep. They were always second fiddle to the Saints, and you couldn't put that type of resources into the team that you could the Saints. And anybody that was a superstar up until this point could get frustrated with being someone who is an elite athlete and playing in a market that they felt could not help them reach their full potential. So I think the fans were kind of used to, you know, having that beacon of hope, like, hey, we got Chris Paul, we got Anthony Davis, we got, and then, oh, they want to leave and go somewhere else and play for bigger markets. So I think that they were expecting that. They just didn't expect Anthony Davis to go and just quit and somewhat be disrespectful in how he left.
Yeah. You know, I always think of the Eric Gordon Chris Kaman picture whenever, you know, that type of thing comes up, where they're just sitting there. You know, you're used to seeing guys hold up their jerseys with big smiles on their faces, and these guys clearly were just like, get me out of here. And that team, you know, went on to make the playoffs in 2015, but it kind of goes back to that. But at the same time, you know, the whole shirt thing kind of, I thought it was odd, because I actually believed Anthony Davis when he said he didn't have any idea that how people would take that, because he's not the most media savvy person you'll ever see. And I think that he actually does get his clothes laid out for him. And what you saw there was most likely a teaser for Space Jam 2, like a low key, subtle teaser for Space Jam 2. And he's just so oblivious to it. But the thing is, it's not even that. It's not the actions that rub people the wrong way. To me, it was just the failure to just be honest with people after the fact. When he asked to leave, he just spent weeks not being able to tell people why he wanted to leave, giving these kind of half answers that didn't. He just wasn't being honest. He wasn't saying, I don't want to play here anymore. He was saying, it's my time to move on. He wanted to be the good guy while being the bad guy. And even after that, the whole, oh, my stylist laid it out for me. At that point, he did know why people took that the wrong way, and he should have owned it, and instead he didn't, and he backed off. And that's part of the reason I thought that interview with Shams was actually kind of like refreshing, because he gave real answers in that interview, which is, if he had done that on his way out the door, people wouldn't have been happy about it. They would have still been mad. He probably would have still been booed. But there would have just there wouldn't have been this level of vitriol that you're booing a graphic on the screen. He's not hearing that. He's not there. Who are you booing? But that's kind of where we're at. And even in that interview, he talked about stuff like that time he flicked off the fan. Like, even that moment when he was answering that question, he was actually honest. Like, Shams asked him if he would have done anything differently on his way out. And he started by saying no, which is his kind of push-button answer. And then he thought about it, and he said, well, I probably wouldn't have flicked the fan off because that's just not cool. You know, he got fined for it, and he looks back at it. It does look bad, but he explained it. He said, and I'll quote here, he said, you know, no one wants to see their guy leave, but it was like, you know, last game, a couple games left, and it just kept going. Like, man, 3 weeks passes, a month passes, and it just never stops. It was just weighing on me. Like, man, should I have waited until the end of the season or, like, whatever? But the fan just hit me with something. It was just all the emotions balled up in one. It just happened. That's the one thing I regret. And I understand that. You listen to that, and that's a guy telling you how an entire city just hammering him for weeks after weeks after weeks just got to him. And it's easy to forget that this dude's 26 years old. He's lived here his entire professional life, and all of a sudden, he is enemy number one. So, I think that was the biggest issue with him leaving. He didn't control the message. He allowed Rich Paul, not to be confused with Cliff Paul, who's the State Farm agent, who has disappeared, by the way. I'm worried about him. He let Rich Paul control that narrative. He let the narrative become he has no control in this. He is just along for the ride. And it alienated him. It alienated the fans. And that's where we're at right now. And so he comes back to town. He sounds like someone who really wants people to like him. And, you know, they asked him if he thought he'd get a tribute video. He said that he isn't sure. I'm pretty sure he won't get one. I think he should get one, personally. I think that as a franchise, it makes sense to disassociate that one half season from the 6.5 seasons he was here just giving everything he had and bringing the Pelicans to the playoffs twice. Not only does it kind of like signal to the fans like this is a new team, it signals to the team you have that this is not like the spare parts that we collected for Anthony Davis. This is the team. We're not just still caught up in that exit strategy. And I think in the long run, it signals to free agents that you know, you're trying to become a place where people want to go. You know, you're trying to change that narrative, like you said before, where you're the black sheep. And I think that coming out and just not being the salty, you know, jilted ex is a good look in general. And I think David Griffin is very aware of that perception around the league. And if they come out with a 30-second thank you for all of this, and they even came in the end and said, except, you know, that last part, I think that would be funny. I think it would be classy. And I think that it's the right thing to do.
If they did do the video, especially so soon, what are the chances that the fans will not boo for the entire video?
And that's fine. I don't know if they will. The fans do their thing.
I don't think if they threw a video up on the board. I think he's going to get booed during pregame like intros. But if they threw a video up on the board, I don't know if he'd get booed. And I think I agree with Jeff that they probably should do the tribute video as bad as things ended. You know, I think Anthony Davis, I can understand why he asked for a trade. I mean, the Pelicans really screwed up a lot of his tenure here. They didn't put the right infrastructure in place. You know, they've since corrected a lot of those things. But I would probably do the video as bad as thing ended. But also, I totally understand, you know, fans booing the heck out of him during the pregame intro.
And he deserves it. I mean, that's the thing. Like, this isn't a zero-sum game. Like, there's very reasonable arguments to be made for, you know, not treating him like the returning savior. You know, he's not Isaiah Thomas getting traded away from the Celtics. He's more a lot closer to LeBron going back to Cleveland the first time, or LeBron playing in Cleveland after going to Miami, if that makes sense. It's hard to say the right words because he left Cleveland twice. The second time was a little more amicable. He also addressed, you know, he talked to LeBron about that experience, and I think, you know, LeBron, to paraphrase, he said, you know, I was scared. And Anthony said the same thing. So I think that it's going to be a cool game to witness. It's going to be a cool atmosphere. And I'm fascinated by the messaging around it and how the fans react. It's going to be packed. The tickets are trending down from where they were. I think after the trade, when they first put the tickets out, I think the average resale was closer to 130 for like the get-in price. And with Zion going out, that dropped. But I think it's still trending around, 80, 85. And obviously, if you've ever bought a Pelicans ticket, you know that that's closer to a playoff price range than a regular season price range. But it's something, it's going to be the spotlight of the NBA for that night, and probably for, the day before, the day after, as you just look at it.
So revisiting some of the particulars from that trade, which I think was one of the more fascinating trades of the last 10 years, maybe one of the more fascinating trades ever. The Pelicans got a freaking haul, all right? They've already turned Anthony Davis into Brandon Ingram, Lonzo Ball, Josh Hart, Jackson Hayes, and Nikhil Alexander Walker. They still have a 2021 first rounder that's top 8 protected. They still have a pick swap in 2023. And they still have an unprotected first in 2024 with the option to defer it to 2025. I thought that was just a phenomenal haul for the Pelicans. And, we're not going to be able to properly evaluate and contextualize this trade for like another 10 years. Getting those first rounders, so far in the future, I think was a smart move, because the Lakers aren't a very good organization. Let's be honest. They kind of stumbled into LeBron. It was more a matter of LeBron just being like, yeah, I just want to play for like the NBA's most marquee franchise. It wasn't really an instance of like great planning and organizational competence from the Lakers. They kind of lucked into this. And Anthony Davis, maybe he could have gone to the Knicks, but he was forcing his way basically there. So I don't know. I think that the Lakers are going to have a real shot to win a championship this year, but there's a chance that these picks are really fantastic picks here in the future too.
I mean, they've stumbled through the better part of the last decade, right? I mean, they picked Brandon Ingram, they pick Lonzo Ball. You could have made arguments in those drafts. However you feel about those two guys or not, you could make arguments they didn't even get the best guys available in those spots. Like would you rather have Jason Tatum? I don't know. But the value in those picks didn't make sense. And Anthony Davis is already doing his whole I'm not, sitting on the fence thing with the Lakers. And if you're the Pelicans, if nothing else, you can say thank the good Lord that you don't have to listen to every Anthony Davis interview as he says, hey, maybe I'll go sign in Chicago, and just, all the wheels start turning and it's, red alert all over again. And that's the Lakers' problem now. I would probably pick them as the favorite to win the title right now, just having watched how that team developed and some of the role players. But, they struck out on Kawhi Leonard. They didn't win that deal. They traded for Anthony Davis, and you could argue that, they win a title. Who knows what happens after that? There's no way to know whether that works out for them. And even on the Pelican side of it, you have to look at the Hawks trade too. I mean, that has elements that could play out. They obviously got Jackson Hayes in that. And Nikhil, but they also got that Cavaliers pick for next season in that trade while unloading Solomon Hill. It's top 10 protected, but which sounded kind of crazy at the time, but the Cavs, they're 5-11. They're sitting right there in the Eastern Conference playoff race. They're, the eighth seed right now is the Magic at 6-9. They're a fringe playoff team. There's no reason to think with Kevin Love, Colin Sexton, Darius Garland that they're going in the tank. As long as they have Kevin Love on that roster, that team is trying to win games. So there's a very reasonable possibility that they make the playoffs in the East, or at least compete for it down the stretch, and the Pelicans end up with a second first-rounder next year that was just kind of a throw-in. If it doesn't convey, it becomes two second-rounders in the next two seasons, which is part of the reason that the Hawks were willing to throw that in. But still, I mean, the assets that they collected, as frustrating as things are right now, like, this is a long play. This is not win a title this year for the Pelicans. This is be competitive for the next decade and be able to build a team around Zion Williamson that they were just never able to do around Anthony Davis.
Yeah, I think the beauty of this trade is that Zion Williamson eventually is going to be the guy who's soaking up, a ton of your cap room. Maybe look at Brandon Ingram too. These extra picks are ways you could fill out your roster and address your weaknesses as you go on, as we get farther and farther into the Zion era. So, we talked a lot about the ugly ending with Anthony Davis. Raina, you have been around, this team more than me, more than Jeff. Do you have, what's, your best memory of the Anthony Davis era? Because I don't want to spend this entire time, just talking about the horrible times. What is there like one most fun memory you have from the Anthony Davis era?
We should have prepped you for this question.
Right. That's what, he's been here for quite some time.
Well, I mean, so just to, while you're thinking about this, just to kind of go back. So Anthony Davis won a national championship at Kentucky, mm-hmm. along with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. They went 1-2 in the 2012 NBA draft. If you remember, that year, the Pelicans also won the draft lottery. The bookends on the Anthony Davis' Zion Williamson era are really fascinating. But I think they jumped from fourth to first that year. And you look at the guys that, you know, I think it was Charlotte that got bumped out. They got Michael Kidd-Gilchrist instead of Anthony Davis. That's brutal. They could have picked Bradley Beal, you know, who's a star for the Wizards right now. They didn't. You know, Damian Lillard also in that draft. So, I mean, the draft lottery, you know, people kind of, a lot of times people kind of just look past it, but it's so, so important yeah. when you're talking about, like, the long-term futures of a franchise.
On the note of drafting, for the most part, the Pelicans have been really bad in who they pick. Just like you said, they got it right with Anthony Davis. And I can't say that there is any specific moment that was just amazing that just stands out for me for Anthony Davis. But, you know, like you said, to get away from the negatives and get into the positive, outside of those past, 3 months that he had with the Pelicans, and no matter how bad they were or how good they were, they had spurts where they were really good when they got DeMarcus Cousins and Rajon Rondo, and they had spurts when they were really bad and didn't even make the playoffs. Anthony Davis was a constant. When he wasn't hurt, he gave you everything he had. He was very present in the community. He never talked bad about his teammates, about his coaching, no matter, you know, getting a different coach or different teammates and all the drama that could be around the Pelicans. And he always stayed positive. He always gave everything he had while he was here. And like you said before, when you think the fans should appreciate that and kind of erase the last 3 months out of their mind at some point in time, they should. But just like any relationship, like you're talking about the bitter ex, you need that closure. Mm-hmm. He did not give them closure at all. He publicly announced that he wanted to break up and then continued to disrespect the ex until leaving and going to go get a superficial new girlfriend right. that might be good for the short term, but probably not the long haul. So, yeah.
It's like he posted on Facebook, "Hey, we're over," and then he started dating.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a bad way to break up, to find out that you're not together the same way that right. all 5,000 of your friends on Facebook find out.
Exactly. Yeah. So you'd like at least a phone call.
Right. You could at least text and let us know that you didn't want to be with us no more, you know?
Yeah, that was the equivalent of like a divorce lawyer serving you with papers or something.
Right.
Rich Paul was the divorce lawyer.
I know things are bad, but I thought we were going to figure this out.
Right. Listen, you know, let's go counseling. Something. Right. Let's figure this out. He did not want to do any of that. He wanted to get out of there and go to Silicon.
He wanted a second honeymoon. That was in Silicon Valley.
Yes, yes.
He got it with King James, who we're still not bound to, as far as I'm aware.
Won't bow down, baby. I've heard that a couple times this year. This was fun, guys.
Yeah.
Appreciate you coming on, Reyna. Lady Texter.
Yes.
Not a Lady Bulldog.
But not a Lady Bulldog.
Tech. T-E-C-H. Not text messages.
Text messages.
Yes.
Louisiana Tech Texters.
Yeah. Now, you all know that, so as you spell it on social media, you can get it right.
Go ahead and subscribe to Birdwatch on Apple Podcasts, BIRDWATCH, Birdwatch Podcast, and appreciate you guys listening.